50 years ago, almost to the day, in fact, the FDA announced approval for oral contraceptives, and not long after, millions of women began taking the pill, as it became known. While some believed this new method would halt unwanted pregnancies and lead to happier marriages, others saw it as a way to cope with America's population bomb and as a potential liberator of sexual attitudes. In her new book, America and the Pill, A History of Promise, Peril, and Liberation, Elaine Tyler May looks into all of those ideas and how the birth control pill became an important tool for many women. She is the Regents Professor of American Studies at the American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. Her book is published by Basic Books, and I'm very pleased she joins me now on our show. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Now, nowadays, women have numerous choices when it comes to birth control: shields, pills, injections, implants, intrauterine devices, IUDs. There were IUDs around at the time. The pill was introduced, weren't there?
Yeah, and especially more forms of IUDs developed in the years after the pill was approved.
And what else was around? Diaphragm sponges, condoms for men?
Condoms for men, and the most commonly used and most effective means before the pill was the diaphragm.
And since the diaphragm was effective, why did anyone think that we even needed a pill?
Well, there are a lot of things that are really revolutionary about the pill as a form of birth control. First of all, it completely separates the act of contraception from the act of sex. So you don't have to interrupt the flow of passion. You don't have to, there's no appliances involved. There's no hassles or muss or fuss. A woman can be on the pill. I mean, the most important thing really is a woman can be on the pill and her partner, her sex partner, doesn't have to participate or cooperate or even necessarily know about it. It's totally in the control of the woman. And that was the first time anything like that had ever been available.
So the male partner was taken out of the equation, but doctors were brought into the equation, although doctors had to prescribe the diaphragm as well.
That's right.
And the IUD.
That's right. It brought a third party into this contraceptive equation. With a diaphragm, you're fitted for it, you get a prescription, and that's it. The pill, you had to get a prescription and be monitored. You had to go in for checkups. You had to get refills. And what's interesting about this is that it actually helped to change the relationship between women and their doctors. At the time, in 1960, almost all doctors were men. There were a few women doctors, but nothing like today. It was very rare that a woman would be in this field. So here you have women patients, male doctors, at a time when doctors were largely considered to be gods. And one of the first things that happened with the pill is women rushed to their doctors, healthy women rushed to their doctors to demand a prescription. And doctors were completely taken aback by this because ordinarily a patient would come in, they would examine them, say, this is what you need, give it to them. And suddenly their patients were coming in and requesting things, and that was entirely new.
Were all doctors happy about that? For example, with abortion, which was illegal at the time, many doctors, even today, would prefer not to perform them. Some refuse to perform them. We're even seeing pharmacies people now are not willing to dispense the pill, even though they've been prescribed.
That's right. And that's really the result of the backlash against, it's a political issue, the backlash against reproductive rights. And it's very scary. In 1960, and even before 1960, it would really depend. A lot of doctors were very sympathetic and wanted women to have access not only to contraception, but also to abortion. And the sympathetic doctors would make proposals that either contraception or, in some cases, abortion were necessary for the health or for saving the life of the woman. And that was the way they would sometimes find legal ways to manage these things, even in times and places where it was not legal. So I think that there was probably a wide range of sentiment on the part of medical professionals regarding these issues.
Was Enovid the first oral contraceptive that the FDA approved?
Yes.
Who manufactured it?
Searle.
Was it an immediate source of great income in the way that Viagra has been for Pfizer?
Well, I don't know the dollars, but it was a great immediate source of huge income for Searle and then for all the pharmaceuticals that ended up developing and marketing birth control pills. They made a fortune, and it's a little bit ironic because initially they were very wary of investing in research and development for contraceptive products, particularly the pill. The pill was used and approved in the mid-1950s as a cure for infertility, actually, because it suppressed ovulation, and the idea was a woman would take it temporarily and then stop taking it, and it would recharge their cycle and their system, and then they would ovulate. So one of the funny things about the pill is that when the FDA approved it for treating menstrual irregularities and infertility, suddenly 500,000 American women showed up at the doorstep of their doctors with a condition that had never been diagnosed or treated before, menstrual irregularity. And it was sort of wink, wink. The doctors and their patients knew that they were using these for contraception. So, but to actually do the research for a contraceptive product like this, they were afraid. They were afraid of a backlash. They were afraid of the Catholic Church. They thought it was unseemly. The government would not put any money into it. President Eisenhower said, this isn't the business of government. We have nothing to do with this whole issue. So the pharmaceuticals didn't put in any money, and neither did the government, and yet they made a fortune from it.
Well, a number of different people were involved in pushing it. Margaret Sanger, who, of course, earlier had promoted the diaphragm, Catherine McCormick. But then we have Carl Gerasi, who is the first person to figure out how to actually come up with some kind of a chemical contraceptive. Is it instructive that he was doing it in Mexico City and not in the United States?
Well, he was working with Syntex, and there were Syntex was one of the pharmaceutical companies that was working on developing an oral contraceptive. So that was one of many companies that were involved in this development. And certainly Gerasi, Gregory Pincus, John Rock, these are the names that are very much associated with the pill. What has been lost, I think, to a lot of people, not so much Sanger, because she's a pretty well-known name, although I don't think people necessarily associate her with the pill, but Catherine McCormick. Now, there is really the key person, because when no one else would put in any money, Catherine McCormick, a very wealthy feminist widow who had come from a wealthy family but then had married into the McCormick family from international harvester fame, she put millions into the development of the pill at a time when no one else would.
Now, they had to test it.
Yes.
And dosage has always been a controversial issue, hasn't it? And there are many people who still see the way that it was tested in countries where there were people of color rather than in the United States as a form of racism.
Right.
Human guinea pigs.
Yes. And, you know, I think most medical historians, and including feminist medical historians who've now looked at this whole issue from some distance, to some extent feel that these studies have gotten more criticism than they deserve. For one thing, John Rock was practicing in Massachusetts. He was a Catholic physician practicing medicine and doing research in a state that did not allow contraception at all.
He was a conservative Catholic, and
yes,
he thought
was.
That the church would embrace the pill. Didn't
he did.
He
did.
Why did he think that?
Well, he thought it because of the way the pill worked, that it was a hormonal compound that actually did not do anything to separate a sperm and an egg from getting together. And so he felt that because the pill would mimic the hormonal composition of a woman's body during pregnancy, that it actually conformed to what the church actually wanted to do.
Well, he was wrong.
He was wrong. But nonetheless, he was obviously very excited about the possibilities of the pill. And when Rock and others looked for places to test the pill, Puerto Rico was a very logical place. It was already set up with a lot of family planning clinics, and the only thing available to the women there was surgical sterilization. And the women in Puerto Rico were really eager for a reversible contraceptive. And so when these studies showed up, women lined up around the blocks to be part of them. They had to have waiting lists. And this wasn't the only place that the pill was tested. It was tested within the U.S. as well. My father was one of the developers, and he was testing the pill in Los Angeles. And I was one of the guinea pigs. So, you know, there were a lot of people from all over the world who participated in these studies.
My guess is Elaine Tyler May, her book America and the Pill. It is published by Basic Books. When you say you were one of the guinea pigs, since they were guessing at dosage, isn't that something that should have been a concern?
Well, I was 12 years old when the pill was approved in 1960, so I wasn't one of the early so-called guinea pigs or participants in these studies. But there's a few things I think that are really important to remember about the early trials. They were testing a 10-milligram pill, a whopping dose of hormone. Why were they doing that? Well, for one thing, they knew that it worked. They knew that the 10-milligram pill would suppress ovulation. And they could say to women, look, we know this is going to work. If you participate in these trials, we'll monitor you, and we will take care of you and provide this for free. And we know it will work if you use it as prescribed. Now, what they couldn't say, and a lot of people forget this, what they couldn't say in 1960 was, we're going to monitor you, and if you happen to get pregnant, then don't worry, we'll know within days, and we'll take care of it, very simply. Because, of course, this was before Roe v. Wade. It was not legal to do abortions at the time. And they didn't know if they lowered the dosage, whether or not it would actually prevent pregnancy. And they couldn't ask women to participate without being able to make that guarantee.
Has any follow-up been done with the women who were taking those very high doses?
Well, we know that the high-dose pill caused a lot of side effects and, in some cases, some very serious risks, particularly in terms of blood clotting. And there were very serious problems early on. One of the difficulties is we don't really have good data on a control group because we don't know how likely it was or how frequent it was in the general population for these conditions. But we do know, and it's been widely documented, that the high-dose pill was dangerous. Even though millions of women took it without any problems at all, a few had serious problems. And so when the dosages were declined and you had a safer pill, those problems were largely eradicated. But even today, we have side effects and difficulties with the pill. It's not a perfect contraceptive even now.
Well, is the pill used in as often as it was at the height of its popularity?
Today in the United States, 80% of women of childbearing age at one point or another have used the pill.
Now, we talked about it originally being promoted as an infertility drug,
right.
But with everybody understanding that it also was a contraceptive, some people saw it in other ways. Some people saw it as a way to cut down on population growth.
Right.
And Hugh Hefner very quickly, along with some women who might not have wanted to even consort with Hugh Hefner, saw it as something totally different again.
Well, these are two big issues. One is the whole question of population control, and the other is the sexual revolution. And we now know that the pill had pretty much nothing to do with either one. In the developing world, where so much of the concern about population growth was focused, for a woman to go on the pill, she had to live in a place where, first of all, there was health care, and there were health practitioners around who could give prescriptions, follow-up exams, and renew prescriptions. Very few women in the developing world, in small villages, had access to that kind of medical care. Secondly, in many cases, even if they did have access, it would have been very difficult in many communities for women to have that kind of autonomy. These were patriarchal communities. These were very tightly controlled family systems. And it really wasn't until much later that women were empowered to the point that they could actually take advantage of contraceptive opportunities.
According to a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, the latest statistics, which go back a few years, reveal that 3.1 million women a year have unwanted pregnancies.
Right.
So the pill isn't having all of that much of an effect around the world.
Right. And also in the United States. I mean, this was another one of the great utopian dreams, was that the pill would put an end to unwed pregnancy and unwanted pregnancy. And that, of course, didn't happen. On the other hand, what very few people imagined at the time was just how important the pill would be as a tool for women's emancipation. And that's because the pill arrived in 1960, just as the feminist movement was beginning to open up new doors to women.
And some women saw it as a godsend. Others later saw it as something that just caused a lot of trouble.
Well, the people who saw it causing trouble were also wrong. Those at the time who were afraid that the pill would unleash sexual chaos among the unmarried were wrong because very few, very, very few single women actually got hold of the pill during the 1960s for sure, and even well into the 1970s.
Because doctors weren't prescribing it to them?
Because in many places it was illegal and it was unavailable, and also because, you know, just because the pill came along, suddenly it didn't put an end to the double standard, put an end to social values that were changing at the time, but they didn't change suddenly in 1960 because the pill came along.
The New York Observer recently ran a piece called Feminist Theory, which discusses the younger mom of today who's less concerned about putting off having children or abortion rights or birth control. I don't know if you've heard about that.
The
changing attitudes of a younger generation.
FAM, the Fertility Awareness Method. Well, a lot of those young women, it's very interesting. It's a way to scientifically control their fertility by body awareness. And that's really taken hold with a lot of women who are not eager to put chemicals into their bodies.
Over the years, we've heard about attempts to come up with a male pill.
Right.
And just last year, Chinese researchers reported successful trials of what could become a male birth control pill.
Chinese researchers 50 years ago were also on the verge of bringing forth a successful male birth control pill. What's kind of interesting is that since 1960, when the pill was approved, we have had dozens of new products for women, contraceptive products, as you mentioned earlier, you know, different versions of the pill, IUDs, all kinds of patches and implants and whatever. And during those 50
cervical
years,
caps.
Everything. Mm-hmm. During those 50 years when all these dozens of new products have come out for women, you know how many new products for men have come out for contraceptive devices? Exactly zero in those 50 years. We still have the condom, nothing else. But for 50 years, there's been the promise of a male pill just around the corner. Maybe it is around the corner.
I'll tell you, I feel very guilty. Elaine Tyler May is Regents Professor of American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. She's the author of several books, including Homeward Bound, American Families, and The Cold War Era. Her latest is called America and the Pill, and it's published by Basic Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.